Hi, I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and this is the Marketplace Weekend Podcast for the weekend of July 10th, 2015. Sometimes when I write this show, I look for perfect little tie-ins or poetic coincidences that meld the larger themes of our show with what's going on in the world. So I admit that this week, in a show about legacies, I really, really wanted the word legacy to have a Greek root. After a lot of time with dictionaries, though, legacy seems to come from the Middle Ages and from Latin. From the concept of the person who is delegated, an ambassador, if you will, to pass things on. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and this is Marketplace Weekend, where the economy collides with real life. This episode, focused on legacies, is all about what we pass on. Money, technology, music, and yes, the foundations of democracy and math that Greece gave to Europe. You can tell us what you want your economic legacy to be. Just go to marketplaceweekend.org and click on Go. Visit Marketplace's Facebook page or tweet us. We're at MarketplaceWKND. Crisis, chaos, a Gordian knot all but impossible to untie. Yep, that image and those words come from Greek roots. Remember, I already told you I spent a lot of time with dictionaries this week? We wanted to start the show by exploring Greece's legacy, what it gave to Europe, and how that's played out economically in this crisis. Marketplace's European correspondent Stephen Beard has been reporting from Athens. Thanks for joining us.
Hello, Lizzie.
When we talk about the Greek legacy, I'd like you to weigh in a little bit on the classical legacy of Greece and how that seems to be invoked over and over again in this ongoing, I hate to say it, drama.
Yes, indeed. Yeah, these are the well-worn cliches. Journalists have plundered Greek mythology to describe this crisis. Sisyphus rolling his stone up the hill, Hercules cleaning the Augean stables, and so on. Oddly enough, though, some people do believe that the classical heritage, the classical legacy, plays an important role in the modern psychology of the country. Because the rest of Europe, in fact, the rest of the world, owes an enormous cultural debt to Greece, because we've all borrowed so heavily from Greek philosophy, culture, and language. The very word Europe comes from Greek mythology. Because of this, some argue, the Greeks have a rather distorted view of themselves and their relationship with the rest of Europe. Here's Helen Stathis, a senior Greek banking official, who feels the classical heritage has convinced many Greeks that the rest of Europe owes them a living.
Most of us think that it's always others to blame, and it's we are the gift of God to humanity, because our ancestor was Plato and Aristotle, and we invented mathematics and democracy, and for that reason, Germans should cut down our loans. I mean, this is not logical. We are clever people, so I don't know. We need to change the way we think.
And it's interesting to note that the new economy minister, by the way, is called Euclid, the inventor
of... Father of mathematics.
Absolutely, and geometry in particular. So we are looking for some new angles on the Greek debt crisis.
You had a man tell you that modern Greeks were behaving like children. What happened there?
Yes, I mean, this... this guy's going to get into trouble, I think. The Germans have certainly complained about that. That's been a regular refrain from the Germans. They say the Greeks are behaving like children. And this gentleman, Kostas Papadopoulos, he's one of the country's top book publishers, and he agrees.
I can point out who I think is the most responsible, who has the biggest responsibility for the situation in Greece now. And I would say the Greek mama.
So, you know, that is going to get him into a lot of trouble. Yes, Costa says the typical Greek mother has helped cause this crisis because of the way she's traditionally raised her children.
She does not let them breathe. She's breathing for them. And the result is when we grow up, we think that my mom is going... the whole of the world will be like our mom, that will serve us. Well, I can tell you that the world is not like that. Nobody's going to serve us. We need to fight for ourselves, and we need to respect other people. We're not expecting other people to do what my mum was doing.
But Costa says he's not going to get into trouble with his own mum because he wasn't raised like that. which might explain why he's a very successful Greek businessman, although indeed through no fault of his own, his business has been severely damaged by the crisis.
Thinking about the legacy of this crisis on regular Greeks, Stephen, we've already seen unemployment in the 25% range, youth unemployment at 50%. Is the legacy a lost generation potentially in the future?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, that is the legacy of the country's euro membership. Had they not been in the euro, had they had their old currency, the drachma, there's every likelihood they wouldn't have seen this catastrophic level of unemployment. They would have been able to depreciate their currency. They could have had a lot more tourism as people flooded into this country, which would be cheaper as a result. In spite of that, something like 75-79%, according to the opinion polls, of Greeks absolutely want to stay within the eurozone.
Marketplace's Stephen Beard in Athens. Stephen, thank you so much for your reporting.
Thank you, Lizzie.
Years ago this month, entrepreneur Jeff Bezos launched Amazon.com, and the website sold its first book. Now the company has changed the way we shop and the way a lot of companies do business. To put Amazon's legacy in perspective and talk about what's coming next, we've got our senior tech correspondent, Molly Wood. Nice to have you back.
Thanks, Lizzie. Happy to be here.
Amazon's 20th birthday. Okay, it's 20 years old. What has changed? What's the legacy there?
Yeah. Here's Amazon, can't even drink, change the world. I think Amazon first established and then completely changed e-commerce and then went ahead and changed the way that people shop entirely. So if you back all the way up to that time, oh so long ago, when Amazon came along and was selling books, it was disruptive, to use the current favorite Silicon Valley parlance. Everybody likes to. And sometimes there's just not a better word. And this is one of those cases. But Amazon did a couple things that I think will stand as its legacy, the thing that really changed shopping. The first was probably one-click buying. And that just made shopping so easy. And e-commerce, it took some of the friction out of e-commerce in a way that no one ever had before. And then they kind of doubled down on that with this idea of Prime.
Explain how Prime works for people who are outside the fold.
So Prime is basically a yearly subscription that you pay to get better shopping experiences on Amazon. So it costs about $100 a year, and it comes with free two-day shipping on items that are marked for Prime. So not everything in the Amazon catalog can be bought on Amazon Prime, but a lot of things can. And if they are marked as Prime, you can get them with two-day shipping. And over the years, they've sort of expanded the capabilities of Prime. So it used to just be the two-day shipping, which was great. I mean, that would pay for the $99 all by itself in a year. But now it also includes some free movie and TV streaming, some audio streaming, and increasingly just sort of more benefits.
When you think about this in sort of a twofold way, how has the technology enabled that? And also, has it sort of made us spend more money? I mean, it's got to be making money for them if this is their favorite thing, their big bet, right?
Yeah, I mean, that is the absolute genius of Prime. $99 a year is not a lot of money for a company like Amazon. But what happens is that Prime members end up shopping so much more because the ease of one-click shopping combined with free two-day shipping, combined with sort of access to sales that you might not otherwise get, means that for a lot of people, it's actually easier to shop on Amazon than it is to shop on stores. And that, to me, is sort of the enduring legacy. The fact that they made it seem like a waste of my time to go to Target for toilet paper or toothpaste. And so you have this whole sort of, you have this population of people, of Prime members, who consider buying things on Amazon to be the only way to shop. And that is a pretty remarkable thing to accomplish.
That is a pretty remarkable thing. When you think about how Amazon has, if we're going to use the word, disrupted the world of e-commerce, it's also disrupted the world of commerce in general. How does that begin to shape our future?
I think that there are real questions that have to be answered once people start to think about online as the only way to shop. And one of the interesting questions that's come up only recently is the idea of packaging. So if I get my toothpaste and my toilet paper and all of my, increasingly even my groceries from Amazon, it may be convenient for me, but every one of those things is coming in a big cardboard box. It's including packaging. It's including, you know, bubble wrap. And so there's sort of this interesting question about the impact of shipping all of this stuff, the physical impact on the world. And then there is the pretty, you know, there's the ongoing debate about stores. And what happened to stores? I mean, it, you know, so far, it's been really major stores like Target or Walmart that have been able to survive the Amazon onslaught. But as they increase that catalog.
Yeah, you see Borders, you know. Boy, where did that bookstore go?
Remember when Barnes & Noble used to be the big evil? Used to be the big bad?
Yeah.
Now you walk by a Barnes & Noble and you feel kind of bad for them because of Amazon.
So thinking about shipping is obviously one thing when you evaluate the environmental impact. The other thing that feels like it's hanging out there is the question of drone delivery. I mean, that sounds so ridiculous when we first started to talk about it, but is that going to become normal?
Yeah, I mean, if the legacy was one click and Amazon Prime, the legacy is going to become like a weird little connected internet device that you talk to reorder things, and the possibility that robotic drones are going to deliver groceries to you or deliver other kinds of goods. I mean, Amazon apparently is very serious about this. They are going to launch delivery by drone, which will only sort of, assuming that it's not a totally terrifying descent of horror from the skies.
Raining avocados or what have you. Yeah.
Raining avocado, exactly. Toothpaste boxes falling everywhere. It sounds kind of crazy, but if you think about the convenience that could come from that, Amazon's already experimenting with same-day delivery for certain items. I mean, they're kind of just trying to come up with a way to make sure that, Amazon's all you ever think of when you think of needing a new thing.
Molly Wood is our senior tech correspondent. Thank you so much, Molly.
My pleasure, Lizzie.
We're exploring the idea of legacies today, but before we get back to that, let's look at some of the biggest numbers in the news this week. Every day, Marketplace's By the Numbers blog tracks them and posts them at marketplace.org. Here are digital producers Tony Wagner and Tobin Lowe. Tony?
Thanks, Lizzie. Our first number is...
$130.
That's how much Bert Shavitz,
the man behind the Burt's Bees brand,
was paid for his shares of the company.
His co-founder Roxanne Quimby bought him out in 1999. She later went on to sell the company for $1 billion.
Burt reportedly got another $4 million out of that, but in interviews, he said the house he bought was reward enough.
He passed away earlier this week at the age of 80.
$6,842.
That's how little a professional women's soccer player sometimes makes in a year for her time on the field.
Compare that with the U.S. men's soccer team, whose players have a minimum annual salary of $60,000.
To make ends meet, many women's soccer players also have a 9-to-5 job.
30.
That's how many profiles you can now prioritize in your Facebook newsfeed.
It's one of several changes Facebook rolled out this week. The company wants to make our newsfeeds more personalized.
Tobin, am I going to be in your top 30?
Maybe 31.
We've talked about economic and historical legacies in Greece, the legacies of giant companies like Amazon. Now, a story that's both intimate and about celebrity legacy on a grand scale. Amy is the new documentary about Amy Winehouse, the British singer-songwriter who died at the age of 27, like many musicians before her. Jimi Hendrix, Janis Joplin, Kurt Cobain. What's sometimes referred to as the 27 Club. Winehouse's struggles with addiction were well-publicized, but so was her incandescent talent. I asked the documentary's director, Asif Kapadia, to describe the legacy that he was trying to show.
I guess for me, making a film, it was all about getting underneath all of that sort of stuff about fame and people on a pedestal and you know, pop stars or rock stars, and actually just taking Amy off the stage, take off the wig, take off the makeup, and just show the real girl underneath, the ordinary girl, the girl next door, the girl that could have kind of, I might have bumped into in a record store or bumped into on the subway in London. I like meeting the ordinary girl who worries about her spots and, you know, worries about what she looks like when she sees herself, and realizing she's really funny and witty and just normal, and a really cool kid who had a sense of humour, who just also happened to be a great singer, also happened to play the guitar and be able to write amazing songs that, you know, everyone loves. The danger of her becoming this kind of megastar, pop star, was that's the person that's easier to attack, which is what happened.
So is the idea of crystallizing a legacy then sort of anathema to what you were trying to do?
Yeah, because, you know, at the beginning, there were loads of people who talk about, you know, oh, that kind of number where rock stars die. And I was like, I'm not interested in that. I think that's stupid. And
you
I
know I'm going to ask you about
yeah,
it, though.
Yeah, I know, and it's stupid. And it's like, we wouldn't celebrate it for, you know, I don't know, dentists all died at that age or radio presenters. And so the idea that people die young, it's not cool. I think it's silly and I think it's terrible. And so, again, I didn't want her to be part of that gang. I just wanted her to say, look, as a person on her own, is really special and cool and talented and beautiful, and that's the way I would love people to remember her, not as part of a gang of rock stars who all died stupidly young.
At the age of 27.
Yeah.
So there were two things that struck me that I really wasn't expecting, one of which was her handwriting.
Hmm.
Is when you look at those lyrics that she was writing out in notebooks, and I think it's the sessions in Miami, they're like a little girl's handwriting, these very rounded bubble letters, and I was really jarred by that.
Why?
Maybe because it was underneath that veneer, and it just seemed so raw. And then the other thing that seems raw, and I'm curious about why...
It's a word that comes up a lot,
yeah.
Actually, raw. It's kind of what the aim of the film is, to take away the shiny, glossy, soft focus star, all the spotlights. And actually, the whole thing, right from the beginning, you hear her singing when she's just messing around for mates, picks up a guitar, it's raw. And that's why she's great. There's no BS, you know. It's actually, she really has it. Her voice is amazing at its rawest. And actually, yeah, that's the kind of the word that I would almost use. It's about love, in it, essentially, this film, all forms of love. And it's all about showing everything at its most raw.
You know that people are going to ask you about the sort of complicated space between what she leaves behind and then what this documentary leaves behind. And I guess I'm curious, if the film has a legacy, what is that?
I hope the legacy is just about rebalancing the public's perception of her. You know, at the beginning when I was doing my research, I remember, you know, I'd hear about a particular article or an interview she gave, and I'd Google her name, and one horrible image after another would come up of Amy.
Yep.
That's how Amy was summed up. Her falling out of a club or a bar or punching someone or looking really messed up because of her addictive kind of issues. And what I'd love is, you know, when we Google now, you see a beautiful picture of her. You see a picture of her holding a guitar, or you see a picture of... So partly it was just the public perception.
Of course, but the horrible pictures are a part of her life.
Yeah, but that's not everything. You know, that doesn't sum her up. That's her at a bad point in her life. And actually, for me, the most important part was the creative Amy, the younger Amy. For me, it's more interesting and more special. And if you don't know that existed, then you don't care about it. You know, right at the start, I mentioned to somebody in London I was going to do this film, and, you know, pretty intelligent person in the business, and said, you know, his answer was, why do you want to make a film about a junkie? And that was exactly the reason why I felt I had to make the film, because that's how she was being summed up by people. Those images did sum her up, because, you know, the word that comes up the most here in the US when I do interviews is train wreck. That's what everyone thought she was. She was a train wreck. I suppose the legacy was not just the film and her depiction and how people thought of her, but to have this type of debate that we're having now, for writers to start talking about her, because I don't remember this all happening when she died.
Hmm. Your film also charts the moment where she gets a deal, she buys her first place. Suddenly there is a lot of money around someone who'd always lived with her family. How do you think that amount of material success changed her?
I think there's a couple of things. Amy from everyone I've spoken to, really didn't have that much interest in money. She didn't have interest in the awards. She wasn't in it for that. She was interested in creating and experimenting and pushing and wanted to get into the studio. And she was more interested by which musicians am I going to get to work with. That was really her thing. That's what excited her. What's interesting is when you learn that this kid who's like 17, 18 years old gets £250,000 record deal, and is able to move out. I mean, she moved out, I think, at the age of 15 or something like that, really, really young with her friends. And she was, you know, suddenly she's rich. She's richer than her parents. She's got more money than anyone, you know, and who's going to say no? That's what starts happening. One of the big issues I've had during the film is just this idea of when you have these vast quantities of money, which the music business, I think, is dealing with artists who are younger than the film business, where I come from, and there's more money floating around than in the film business that I come from. And you're just thinking, well, who's in charge? Who's the person in place to say, do you know what? You're not well. I'm not going to let you perform. Whose job is that? Who's the person who will go in there? Because that goes back to your 27 Club thing. Why do so many musicians die young? Because they're given everything. And then who's around to say no? Because everyone who's there is on the team. So if they say no, they get fired. Where does the music business have any responsibility for the artist that it suddenly makes famous and rich? Does anyone take any responsibility in it? And it appears like there's no one in place. In films, on fiction films, when you're shooting a movie, you have an assistant director whose job is to make sure everything goes on time, on budget, and nobody gets hurt. And I don't think that type of person exists in the music business.
Do you blame the business for her death?
I don't know if I blame it, but I think, you know, they're the people with experience. You know, you could say that Amy was she's a kid going through this for the first time. So then it just makes me wonder, is there nobody else in the system? You know, this is a lot of money floating around, like we said. You know, when records sell 20, 30 million copies, then there's quite a lot of money. Every time it gets played on the radio, someone's making money. You know, they know how to get the money in. So the question is, how do they then use that to protect the talent? Because surely an artist who makes 15 albums is going to be better than someone who only made 2.
Yeah. Asif Kapadia is the director of Amy. Thank you so much.
Great. Nice talking to you.
We're exploring the idea of legacies on the show this week. So we went to visit a place built in part on what we leave behind, a museum. At the Museum of Modern Art in New York, curators create exhibits centered around single artists and periods of work. MoMA attracted hundreds of thousands of viewers for a retrospective on Matisse last year. They've kept the museum open 24 hours a day for popular exhibits. And on this summer day, even on a weekday morning, it's already pretty crowded. This September, MoMA is showing an exhibit of Picasso's sculptures, not a medium that's traditionally associated with Picasso. I spoke to the museum's curator and their marketing specialist about how to display and sell an artist's legacy.
I'm Kim Mitchell, Chief Communication Officer at MoMA.
I'm Ann Temkin. I'm the Marie-José and Henry Kravis, Chief Curator of Painting and Sculpture here at the Museum of Modern Art. And we're in a conference room overlooking the sculpture garden.
Healthy-sized crowd already. Tell me about what it takes to curate this exhibit, particularly with an eye toward communicating a part of Picasso's legacy that maybe people aren't as familiar with.
The sculpture is particularly apt a topic for the category of legacy because...
Why?
He was somebody who had a very different relationship with the sculptures than with the paintings. The paintings are what he was trained to do. He went to school to become a painter. He earned his living by selling his paintings. His paintings were made and then most often went straight to dealers, exhibitions, and so on. He didn't go to school for sculpting. He was entirely self-taught. He didn't, for the most part, send them to shows. Dealers begged him for them. He rarely said yes. So when he died, of the 700 sculptures he made, there were scores still with him at his house.
Wow. So, Kim, you all have had the phenomenally successful Matisse cutout show here. That, to my mind, brings a very readily accessible image. When you go to market something like this, Do you need just a picture that a tourist on the street can identify with, or that someone easily associates with Picasso?
Well, that's the fun part. We work closely with the curators and the estate to identify that key image, because we do believe that a signature image will help people understand what the show is about. And our job in this case is to convey something that may be an unexpected and lesser known aspect of Picasso's career.
So what does it look like?
Well, that's what we're going to be working on this summer. There is an image on the website now that can be a little bit of a peek into what we'll be looking at. But we work, you know, collaboratively in terms of something that looks, you know, exciting and fresh and new, but that also works well on a subway poster and in a small digital ad. So there's a lot of factors to take into consideration.
When you think about sort of a headline show like this, what's the almost cost-benefit analysis for the museum in terms of how you put in your time to market and sell something, what the payoff is when you have a big marquee show that brings in lots of people? How do you kind of go through those calculations in your head?
Well, the way it works at the museum is the shows and the program come first, and the curators and the director decide what are the important shows for MoMA to focus on, what are the areas of unexplored activity that might be a fresh way of looking at an artist, and then we look at the year as a whole and decide, you know, where we're going to put campaigns. But we don't do a cost-benefit analysis in the traditional sense. We're here to support the mission, and the mission is the program.
All right, Anna, I'm going to ask you, got to give me a little preview. Paint me a picture of what this stuff looks like.
Happy to give you a little preview. And it's a kind of paradoxical topic because, on the one hand, what could be more famous than Picasso?
Right.
And on the other hand, if you say to people, so tell me what a Picasso sculpture looks like, it's really hard. One of the best loved sculptures, which has been in our sculpture garden for over half a century, is the bronze She-Goat from the 1950s, which absolutely captures viewers' hearts. Constant photo ops of people with the She-Goat. That was something that Picasso made when he was already 70 years old.
Wow.
And there's 50 years of sculpture before that, another decade after. And the thing that characterizes the sculpture most, even more than the painting, which is kind of hard to believe, is variety. That's the one word. With his paintings, at least you always have oil on canvas. With the sculptures, he goes from working in when he was very young and still sort of a 19th century artist, bronze heads that you would actually be able to recognize that this is the face of so-and-so, and then immediately with cubism goes into using materials like wood and cardboard and sheet metal and found objects like a spoon or upholstery fringe and all sorts of things in a kind of three-dimensional collage mentality. And then every decade in his career, completely different technical approach and completely different materials. So it's almost going to feel like a group show rather than a one-person show.
Multiple Picassos.
Yeah.
I know this is a multi-year process, but ballpark it for me. How much does it cost to put on a show like this?
We
Yeah.
don't even...
And?
I'm happy not to know.
Really? You guys don't know?
Oh, there are definitely people here who know. But not in this room.
Fair. And in terms of getting people through the doors, this is a museum where people pay to come in. Who are you targeting to come in those doors and see this show? How does that work?
We really try to make it accessible to everyone. There's an admission to come into the museum, but there's also times to come in for the, yes, for an adult. But there's discounts for students and seniors. There's free Friday nights, and there's lots of students who come in for free. And then there's members who have free admission all year long, including a special member preview for Picasso. They'll be the first ones in the door to see this show. But in terms of who we're reaching out to, we really want, you know, the widest possible audience. We want New Yorkers here, visitors to New York from around the world, from around the country. So it's a very wide reach, and that's why we have to use every channel.
When you think about the idea of legacy, is it harder to curate a show with an artist like Picasso than someone who maybe people know a little less? I think when we're working on a show, we think this is the hardest one. So you're working with living artists. Oh, it's much harder with living artists. Oh, you're working with Picasso. Oh, the Picasso is the most difficult. I'm going to ask each of you just to sum up for me a tagline of what you want people to experience, and then give me a tagline of how you're selling it. What I want a visitor to experience is pleasure. That's it for me. Where that pleasure comes from is different for everybody. How much one learns, how much one associates it with one's own personal experiences, you know, countless factors go into how an individual experiences a show, but it's an easy answer for me.
And for you, Kim?
I would say discover the Picasso you may not know.
Anne Temkin, Kim Mitchell, thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Earlier this hour, we talked about the legacy of one musician, Amy Winehouse. We turn now to the legacy of music and how we buy it. Things have changed frequently and rapidly in the world of streaming music. Consider the footprints of Napster, iTunes, Spotify, YouTube, and more. So how did we get here, and where are we going? To answer those questions, I'm joined by Joan Salzman, senior writer at CNET. Welcome.
Thank you so much.
If you go back to the beginning of streaming music, can you find the legacy of Napster in the DNA of the various services that are popping up now?
Absolutely. It's actually a very direct lineage. The very first subscription streaming service is a company called Rhapsody. And Rhapsody actually bought Napster. Napster still exists. You may not realize it. It's a completely legit organization now. It's basically...
It's not the things I downloaded in high school or college?
It's not. It's not anymore. There was a whole kerfuffle about that about 15 years ago. But Napster still exists. It's part of a subscription streaming service today. So that legacy definitely has a direct lineage to what's going on today.
We have seen, obviously, the growth of subscription being a really dominant model, but it didn't seem like that was going to be the thing. And Apple clearly bet on people wanting to own their own music. That's what Steve Jobs said. Why do you think that has dwindled and subscription has taken hold a bit?
The reason is subscription is just such a great deal. It's such a great offering for consumers. You pay $10 a month and you get all the music, all you can eat, no ads. And Apple, because it's been so dominant in that 99-cent download format that they revolutionized, that they began 10 or so years ago, they resisted it for a long time. But because it's such a great consumer proposition, it is a great value, there's been a consumer demand. And you've seen this great uprising, this great surgence of subscription streaming and streaming as a model. And Apple at this point just couldn't ignore it anymore.
Do you think it's surprising that we went in the early part of the streaming business from something that was free, if illegal, to something people were willing to pay for? That always surprised me.
That's an interesting element of where we are with subscription streaming. The difficulty that the recording industry has had to overcome is that period of file sharing, of Napster, when the digitization of music was really beginning, that started this consumer perception that music should be free. And this is a perception that has existed before that, radio. And so Apple, they came in at this time where the recording industry is hemorrhaging money. They go from the golden age of the CD era to the stage where people don't want to pay anything. And Apple threw them a lifeline. They said, well, maybe not albums that are $16, $17, $18 a pop, but 99-cent downloads, at least you won't be making nothing. And so that shifted the perception a bit that, yeah, I'm willing to pay money as a consumer, so long as it's a nice value. 99 cents, I can deal with that. But now that we've entered this new realm, we're getting back to this concept of Is music free? Should it be free? It feels free. And that's where people like Taylor Swift and other artists, they're starting to cry foul.
You wrote about Prince having trouble with this as well, saying, well, wait a minute, if I want to listen to Prince on Spotify, that's not going to happen. If you think about the future, do artists have any leverage to try to keep their catalogs from these streaming services? Or at a certain point, are people just going to sort of say, eh, if it's not streamable, I don't want it?
In one way, this is a really wonderful time for many kinds of artists because we don't have to rely on having your CD at the end of an aisle at a Virgin megastore anymore for you to get out there. You can get your music to people and you don't necessarily need to have a manager. You don't necessarily need to have a label. You can get your music to people completely free and on your own. It definitely helps to
have those
things.
But can you make money?
And you can. There are new ways to make money. It's because we're in this period of transition where artists like Prince, who made his fame during a period that's so different than today, there's a lot of friction between people that have come from that model and now we're entering an entirely new model. A lot of these legacy artists, they're in a different position than new artists are today.
What do you think this stuff's going to look like in 2-3 years?
In 2-3 years, I think that, and this is just my personal opinion, in 2 or 3 years, I think that subscription is definitely going to be the way that most people listen to their music. And I think that Apple becoming part of the subscription streaming model, that's going to be a big change in just consumer awareness of this model. The big problem about it so far in terms of mainstream traction has been that people on the whole just aren't aware of it. People that are music aficionados know about it, and people that are technological first adopters know about it. But the mainstream hasn't. Apple changes that. It's already been growing so much already. In 2 or 3 years, it's definitely going to be the main way that most people listen to their music.
Joan Salzman is a senior writer for CNET. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Every president has an economic legacy that touches our lives. Their accomplishments, or sometimes lack thereof, can color our remembrance of their time in office and sometimes their place in history. With just over a year left in his presidency, Barack Obama seems focused on big-ticket legacy items, a trade deal, negotiations with Iran and Cuba. We've got Aaron David Miller with us. He's the vice president for new initiatives at the Wilson Center and the author of The End of Greatness: Why America Can't Have and Doesn't Want Another Great President. Thanks for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be here.
If you had to sum up President Obama's economic legacy, how would you do that?
The sands haven't even run through the presidential hourglass. A lot can happen in the next 15 months. But if it were 2017 and you were making an effort to assess legacy, I think you'd have to say that you have a president who will argue and may well be appreciated as a guy who brought the United States back from the worst economic dislocation since the early 30s. Even though you have wage stagnation, structural problems with unemployment, and a lot of global instability, see Greece, close parens, and the problem in the Eurozone, I suspect basically that will be viewed as a positive legacy. On the economic side, I think it's mixed, but on balance, the argument will be things could have been a lot worse had it not been for the president's policy.
The argument that things could have been a lot worse, that his policies pulled us back from sort of the brink, is the argument the president himself made to my colleague Kai Ryssdal not too long ago. And yet, what we often hear from Americans is that they don't feel that much better. I mean, if you look at median incomes, they're actually a little bit lower in real terms than when the president took office. So in terms of perception, how do you bridge that gap between, yes, things are better, but people feel a deep sense of unease?
I don't think there is a way to bridge it. I suspect that's why the economic record will be perceived to be a mixed one. I mean, there may well be structural forces in the economy that are literally beyond the capacity of either the R's or D's to affect, let alone transform. And that is a certain reality that the next Republican or Democratic president is going to have to deal with. The whole question of legacy will be left for historians to debate and to argue, and for the public to reaffirm. And here I think Obama is going to have a problem. I think the policy wonks may well appreciate the complexities of his achievements. But Is he going to be one of the three presidents, FDR, LBJ, JFK, identified by their initials? There'll be no BHO, that's for sure.
I'm going to ask you to engage in an admittedly somewhat reductive exercise, which is group for me things that you see as this president's successes and his failures in terms of concrete policy.
In terms of concrete policy, the entire debate over health care will remain a difficult one. You have legislation that affects 1/6 of the nation's economy, passing with largely Democratic support most of the other transformative changes in American history. The Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, three civil rights bill were passed with large and significant majorities, and they came to be appreciated. It took time. They came to be appreciated as national programs. I think the debate over health care, particularly at the state level, is not yet done, and I think that is going to continue to provide a challenge. Dodd-Frank, I think, is extremely important, and I think years from now people will look back and look at this as an important infrastructure change in terms of regulating the markets, particularly given all of the uncertainties that we face. I think withdrawal from Iraq and Afghanistan will be very contentious. Clearly, the situation has fundamentally changed. I think he rightly will deserve credit for at least presiding over certain social cultural changes. The court's decision on same-sex marriage will in fact be seen as a positive. I mean, his appointments of at least two justices helped create that. And I guess I think, you know, on balance, if I had to reduce it truly reducto ad absurdum, Clare Booth Luce once asked Jack Kennedy, great presidents are literally summed up in one sentence. Washington founded the country, Lincoln preserved it during the Civil War, Roosevelt rescued it from the Great Depression and guided America through World War II. What's your sentence? Luce asked Kennedy. And that, in essence, is the issue in unbalance. What is Barack Obama's one sentence? Will it be that he helped bring America back from the most severe economic dislocation since the Great Depression, and he kept us safe from another attack since 9/11 on the continental United States, and helped to fashion a healthcare initiative that had challenged and escaped all of his predecessors? Is that the one sentence that he will be credited with? And will it be good enough to make him a truly consequential president? I think that's the question, and I think it's going to take a lot of time to answer it.
You spent a lot of time at the State Department. Now, in the latter part of the Obama presidency, we are seeing movement on Cuba, Iran, international trade. Why now?
You know, Woody Allen said that 90% of success in life is just showing up. He really is wrong. 90% of success in life, including for presidents, is showing up at the right time. I think the odds of a deal to contain Iran's putative nuclear weapons aspirations was simply not possible during the first Obama administration. A number of factors congealed. I think if you combine that with the search for legacy on trade promotion authority, something that's very important to the president and something that he had aspired to, another timing issue with 15 months or so left on the clock. Cuba had been in the works for a couple of years. It took time to gel, but it was something that the president wanted to achieve. And we'll see, both with Cuba and with Iran, if in fact these transactional arrangements ultimately lead to transformational ones.
Aaron David Miller is Vice President for New Initiatives at the Wilson Center and the author of The End of Greatness. Thank you.
Thank you.
When we think of our own legacies, that can often mean family or children. But the U.S. Census reports 47.6% of women between the ages of 15 and 44 don't have kids. That's the highest percentage since the census started tracking that data. So if you don't have an obvious heir, how do you manage your financial legacy? Sharon Klein is Managing Director of Wealth Strategies at Wilmington Trust. Thanks for being here.
Thank you very much for having me.
When we talk about the idea of leaving a legacy, when a family approaches you or a couple, how do you start that conversation?
Well, a lot of people start with the financial information first. What, you know, how much do you have? What are you invested in? And I think you have to take a step back from that, because that is typically the last part of the conversation is how do you invest your assets? The first part of the question is, what are your goals? What is your family structure? How do you envision your family? How do you want your children to benefit? And you kind of work from there into the financial picture.
And what about couples without heirs or people without heirs? Have you seen more, less of that lately? What do you see?
When it comes to couples who don't have children, in some ways their estate planning is a lot more complicated, because when a couple does have...
It's kind of counterintuitive.
It is counterintuitive. And the reason it's counterintuitive is that if you think about it, a couple who has children, the logical beneficiaries of their estates are, of course, their children. So if you have a couple that doesn't have children, I think you have to counsel them to think a lot more thoughtfully and clearly about who they want to be the beneficiary of their assets. You know, oftentimes the worst thing that you could possibly do is to do nothing. And why is that? Because state law takes over when you don't have a will. It's called the laws of intestacy, and that governs what happens when you don't leave direction as to where you want your assets to go. And so every state has its own intestacy laws, but for example, in New York, if you do nothing, if you're married, your spouse will get everything on the first death. But then on the second death, the surviving spouse's parents will inherit.
Oh, wow.
Yes. The side of the family who inherits is random depending on who dies last. Because the person who dies last, it's their family that's going to inherit the assets.
A lot of this stuff sounds like the rich people world. Is this important if you don't have a lot of money?
Yes, it's so important.
And people will listen and say, oh, come on, what I've got, you know, in my 401k is nothing.
Well, actually, that raises two issues. The first one is that it is so important, I think maybe even more important for people who don't have that much, because if all of your assets is going to pass to the other side's family, leaving your side out in the cold, that could be a more devastating event than if the family is otherwise wealthy and just doesn't get this added bonus of extra assets. So that's very, very important. What's also very important is the way that you go about creating this mechanism, which you can do via a will, which we're talking about. You could also do it via a revocable trust, a revocable living trust, which, as its name suggests, is a trust that's revocable and changeable and amendable by the creator during their lifetime. On death, it functions like a will. But the beauty is that during lifetime, it also functions in the event of a disability. So even if you have very little assets, it's a prearranged mechanism as to how you want your assets to be distributed, how you want to live your life in the event of a disability. If you don't have a living trust, if you don't have a power of attorney, you probably have to go to court for an expensive and potentially embarrassing guardianship proceeding.
People in general are nervous to talk about death.
Yeah.
And a lot of the thinking and planning that goes into what we leave behind.
Mm-hmm.
Are there tips you have learned in your business about how to start that conversation?
It's always a topic that has to be approached with sensitivity. You have to take your cues from your client. And I would emphasize it's not so much thinking about death and mortality, which nobody wants to think about. It's about leaving a legacy. It's about empowering your descendants with the tools that they need to deal with wealth or to deal with a trust or to instill values in their children or to impart a family vision statement. So I think if you think of it in those terms as empowering a family to get together and provide values that's going to last for generations, rather than thinking about it as what are you going to do when you die, it's a lot more palatable.
Sharon Klein is Managing Director of Wealth Services at Wilmington Trust. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me. Appreciate it.
And that's our show for this week. Next week on the show, we're going out of our comfort zones and focusing on adventure. In the words of a children's book I loved, adventure is good for the soul. Bonus points if you can tell me what the book is. Our show is produced by Eliza Mills, Jenny Ament, and Raghu Manavalan. Dan Semitovich is our senior producer, and Bill Lance is our engineer. Our theme music is composed by Naren Rao. Deborah Clark is Marketplace's executive producer and vice president. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Thanks for listening. This is APM.